Music Session number 10657, Reel 35.
I think you were saying that when you were shot, you'd got your arm raised, and it that probably saved you from a much more serious wound.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. It was I actually spotted him as he fired at me and fired at him at the same time, but by raising my right arm, because I was carrying I had a pistol with me, by raising my right arm, I in fact raised my shoulder blade at the back. So the bullet nicked my ear, gouged the side of my face, went into the top of my shoulder without hitting the bone, came out under the shoulder blade at the back. So I was really extremely lucky. I think also that it did make a little tiny nick of my lung, which was discovered some time later by some officers, some surgeons, when they looked at me in Switzerland. Anyway, I think there was something in what you say. It could well be that the paras up the trees were looking for officers and for sergeants, and he could well have heard me shout, "Get into the Vines, B Company," or something, and have been looking out for me or somebody like me.
Well, the fact that you were using a pistol would also mark you.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I think you said earlier on that your usual custom was to carry a rifle.
Yes, I did at Alamein. I think I did at Marath. I don't know if there's any reason for that, but I think possibly in a close country situation, you're probably better off with a Tommy gun or a pistol, if you get a choice, you know, rather than a rifle. I think a rifle, well, as we said earlier, a rifle with a bayonet on the end is a very useful thing. But I think, anyway, there's no doubt that it was a pistol, because had it been a rifle, I wouldn't have raised my arm so much. I would have been like that more, and it would have been into my shoulder. But it was the fact that I raised my arm that did the trick. And I think very, very soon after that, I was turned over onto my front by a German officer who said to me, "How many divisions are there?" To which I didn't reply. And he went shooting off somewhere very, very quickly. He just, it was in a split second, really.
What had happened then to the chap who was behind you?
I don't know.
Shot your sniper?
I think he was,
sniper.
I don't know. I mean, at all.
He just faded out of the picture.
He wasn't, when I came round, he certainly wasn't there.
So you were unconscious then?
Oh, yes, from that point onwards. I think the last thing I remember, actually, is a German shouting out in perfect English, "Come on, B, are you afraid?" From somewhere in the vines. Some of them spoke very good English, in actual fact. But I think we will stop it there, if you don't mind, because that... Good. Now, the situation elsewhere was that B Company, amongst the vines and the paras, were almost afraid to use their weapons at a range of more than a yard or two for fear of killing somebody on their own side. In fact, the quickest to identify were the ones that lived. If you didn't identify quickly, you'd had it. That was basically what it was. And the ultimate result of all this hand-to-hand fighting was that the two sides more or less fought themselves to a standstill. The front half of B Company, that's to say the ones who'd left the road and gone into the vines, and the paras had nearly 100% casualties. In fact, the only men left in the area were either dead or wounded. And this temporarily broke contact with the paratroops. B Company had gained a little ground from where they stopped on the road in the ditch. Some of us had actually almost got to the sunken road, but having got there, either killed or wounded. The paratroops had also suffered heavy casualties. I would say there wasn't much to choose between the two sides. But, of course, the sunken road, which was the key to the whole of their defensive position, was still intact. Part of B Company, which was about 40 men with the company second-in-command, Captain Dennis Neal. They were still in the roadside ditch. Company Sergeant Major Brannigan, one of the few to survive the hand-to-hand fighting, doubled back down the road to Neal and told him that the rest of the company, 50 or 60 men, had virtually ceased to exist as an effective fighting force, that the company commander and the leading platoon commander were both missing, and that was the situation. Now, Neil decided to try and get forward through the vines, keeping to the left of the Catania Road. But he still didn't have any knowledge of the sunken road, and Brannigan's fighting had been in amongst the vines. Remember, it's still dark, and he didn't know about the sunken road either, so still nobody knew about it. So Dennis Neal and, as I say, about 40 men broke out of the ditch on the left of the Catania Road, and they were probably then about, because they moved up the ditch a bit before they moved off to the left, they were probably about 100 yards short of the sunken road. Now, they started to move to the left, and in fact what they were doing, they were moving across the front of the sunken road. It wasn't light still. There was a lot of shouting to keep direction. Having left the safety, or the shelter, if you like, of the roadside ditch 40 yards behind them, they suddenly found that hand grenades were being thrown at them from the sunken road. There was also heavy and accurate automatic fire. So B Company immediately went to ground among the grapevines. But of course, this didn't give them very much cover, but they went flat. I mean, they didn't get any cover from fire, but at least they weren't standing up and visible targets.
Did they know from which direction the
Yes, they knew that it was coming from that direction, yes. Now, as soon as the dawn came, and it was very soon after they'd actually moved away from the Catania Road, the sunken road became apparent to Neil, and he realised that it was no good keeping the company in such an exposed position. In any case, it was absolutely impossible to push on towards the original battalion objective, which was way beyond the sunken road. And he spotted a large embankment about 8 foot high surrounding a farm building adjacent to the Catania Road, that is to say, back towards the bridge. Now, this farm building was really between where he was with B Company and the bridge and the river, and he decided to withdraw to this embankment. He got the men into widely extended order, but as they began to move back towards the embankment, the paras emerged out of the sunken road and put in a bayonet charge. They overran the rear guard under Sergeant Mitchinson. Mitchinson fell down and shammed being dead. A para kicked him as he ran by and was obviously satisfied and thought he was dead, and the Germans moved on after B Company. Now, as soon as they'd gone about 20 yards, Mitchinson sat up with his Tommy gun and opened fire on them, which caused complete confusion amongst the paratroops, because at the same time, Sergeant Major Brannigan, he stood up and gave covering fire as B Company withdrew. He stood in the open and he just sprayed around. He was a damn good shot as well as a damn good bayonet fighter, and his shooting brought several of the Germans down. But he was a target they couldn't miss, and he was killed just as B Company reached the embankment. It was a typical unselfish action on Brannigan's part. He was a regular army sergeant major. I think he was quite, I suppose you might even say he was quite an old man, because he was 28 years old. But he was a regular army sergeant major. He'd been marvellous at Marath, and here we get him giving his life for the rest of the battalion so they could get back. But Mitchinson and Brannigan eased the whole situation, and B Company were out of danger for the time being. Now, Dennis Neal had got to find a way round the end of the embankment to get into it. And B Company was now down to about 30 men. He got in and positioned his men facing north towards the sunken road and west. Now, I think it's important at this point to try and explain what the embankment looked like. And the best way to describe it, I think, is to say that it was a sort of half circle, with the top of the half circle opposite the sunken road and the bottom facing the river. So the top of the half circle was facing the north, the sunken road, and northwards. The bottom was facing southwards and facing the river. Now, both the top and bottom of the half circle rested on the Catania Road. So the top swung round to the Catania Road and the bottom swung round to the Catania Road. The safest areas, if anywhere in that bridgehead could really be described as safe, were the section opposite the sunken road, immediately opposite, or the riverside of the southern half. That's to say, the other side of the embankment, outside the embankment, really, on the riverside of it. Now, in the middle of this half circle, it was a real high-risk area. Anyone who showed himself was shot at, because so long as the chaps facing the sunken road kept under cover, they were all right. But if anybody walked back to the other side of the embankment, they could be spotted by Germans and fired at. By now, the Germans, in fact, were back in the sunken road, so they're, as we see, their bayonet attack had been beaten back, and Neal has got what's left of B Company behind the embankment. Now, C Company on the right of the road were really worse off than B. They'd had heavy casualties initially. Remnants of the country were scattered around. When the dawn came, they had no officers, and they were only holding on to several scattered localities. So C Company were in a pretty bad way in terms of location. Now, A Company on the right of the road were also on the right of the road, but back towards the river, nearer to the river. Didn't have such a hectic night as B and C, but just before dawn, everything went quiet. And this is the time, generally speaking, when the Germans are at their most dangerous. Everything does go quiet, everything stops before they make an attack. And they came in with a counterattack against two platoons on the right of the A Company front. As we know, the thick vines restricted the field of fire. The paratroops were experts at stalking. They almost got up to A Company positions before being seen. They overran two platoons after fierce fighting in the section positions. Lieutenant Clark was killed. There were heavy casualties on both sides, but the paratroops at this particular point, in any case, had numerical superiority. They drove the two platoons back to the river, where some of the A Company men had to swim to safety, and Chris Beattie, the company commander, brought back the 3rd A Company platoon to the main battalion position by the bridge, at the northern end of the bridge, and also his company headquarters. So here we've got A Company pulling in, more or less, very close to the half circle. by 6 o'clock in the morning, most of the battalion was in close contact with the Germans, and in some parts of the bridgehead, there wasn't much more than about 20 or 30 yards separating the opposing sides. B Company lined the embankment opposite the sunken road. The remnants of C came up and lined the embankment on the left of B. Battalion headquarters was established where the embankment at its southern end looped inwards to join the Catania Road. So there's battalion headquarters north of the bridge, but more or less on the Catania Road and the embankment looping round. D Company, which hadn't had such heavy casualties as the others, was on the other side of the road, level with B and C. And the remnants of A were in position on the same side of the road as D, lining a white wall parallel to the Catania Road. So we've got D Company and A Company on the other side of the Catania Road, but much closer in to battalion headquarters. I think everybody in the battalion knew what a precarious hold they had on the northern bank. They also knew how vital it was that they held on. I think if the battalion had been driven back beyond the Cimeter, it could have seriously affected the whole course of the Sicilian campaign, and they might have been held up there for quite a considerable time trying to get a bridgehead established again on the northern bank. But Colonel Lidwell knew this only too well, and anybody who was at Primosoli can see him now. He very rarely ever wore a hat. Big man, bushy moustache, known as Raggy Tash, I think, standing against the shattered farm buildings where battalion headquarters was located, in a dark shirt, one of these New Zealand dark khaki shirts, torn slacks, pistol slung from his webbing. He walked calmly round the battalion positions. Didn't panic at all, out in the open when it was necessary, didn't crawl around or jump about to dodge anything, and really did inspire tremendous confidence in the men, as in fact he had done at Marath when the CO was killed and Bob took the battalion over. And he got the DSO for the Primosoli action and justly deserved it. Another officer who really distinguished himself at Primosoli was Andrew Noble, Captain Andrew Noble, the medical officer. His RAP was under continuous and heavy fire from just about everything. Artillery, mortars, machine guns. Here again, a very similar situation to what it was in at Marath. He was inundated with wounded, British and German, tremendous, more wounded than he'd ever had to deal with before in any battle. And he really went without rest, day and night, organised speedy evacuation across the bridge to the other side as soon as anybody could be evacuated, and he got the MC at Primosoli. Now, by this time, the bridge was under constant small arms fire. The brigadier had come up, had crossed the bridge so that he could be at battalion headquarters by dawn. And of course he couldn't get back because he came across in the dark. All that could really cross were tanks. And two Shermans did come over the bridge. Now they should have deployed left and right of the road because mistakenly they believed that the vines were an obstacle to progress. In fact they weren't, as we shall see later on. But the German 88, about 800 yards north of the bridge, that's way back beyond the sunken road, very, very quickly put paid to that and opened up on them. The Shermans withdrew back across the bridge, much to the disappointment of the infantry, who felt that with the tanks, had they deployed left and right and beaten down the vines, that they could have got on. The infantry could have got on, and I think they're probably quite right. Anyway, B and C Company The sunken road was still strongly held. B and C were constantly fired at short range. At no point were the Germans more than about 60 yards from B Company. Anybody who showed their head got an absolute fusillade of shots. That's if they showed their head above the bank. the B Company Brens fired at the slightest sign of movement, but they were jamming constantly. Now, the reason for this was that the Brens were rested on top of the embankment. Their tripods were folded under them, and dirt from the top of the embankment was getting at the mechanism. So what Dennis Neal did was to establish a small group at Company HQ to do nothing else but to get the guns cleaned and into action again so that they could keep up a constant fire in the direction of the sunken road.
So it's just dust, was it, getting into the...
Well, yes, that's what it would be. Dust and dirt. It was loose dust and dirt on the top of the embankment. Rather like walking along a thing. You'd press a path along the top with your boots, but the side would all be loose, you know. Well, now, 6:30 in the morning, Colonel Lidwell decided to get his carriers and mortars. The bridge was still under heavy small arms fire, but the carriers crossed flat out, got over safely, didn't get knocked off by the 88, and took cover behind the farm buildings on the right of the road. That is to say, more or less opposite battalion headquarters. Some of the carrier crews were sent to help B Company, opposite the sunken road. The remainder, from then onwards, maintained a precarious supply of ammo and food across the bridge and in the other direction, evacuating wounded. In fact, the bridge was so well covered by fire that it was really suicidal to go on it in anything other than a tank or a carrier, and the brigadier had to go back in a carrier before he could get back again to our side of the bridge, Brigadier Senior, which he did. As soon as they got the supporting arms over, Philip Hampson, the mortar officer, brought his 3-inch mortars into action immediately. He was behind the farm buildings on the right of the road. His shooting was very effective and a great help to the infantry. He covered all the company fronts. He ranged up and down on each side of the Catania Road, that's to say, ranged up and down the ditches on each side and slightly in from the ditches. And he actually wrote very soon after it something about the Germans who we were up against. He said, "The Germans we were fighting were marvellous troops. I can remember firing at two who were walking away with their hands in their pockets and landing about half a dozen bombs behind them. They didn't even trouble to look round." As well as the mortars, the priests were doing a very good work from south of the cemetery. The artillery OPs were up with the mortars on the right-hand side of the road. So the priests and the mortars really formed a team, although I'm not at all certain that it was a very good idea to have all your OPs in one place. Anyway, the CO now called forward two anti-tank guns, and these were towed across the bridge by carriers, and the guns were positioned at the northern end of the bridge. So we're beginning, little by little, to build it up. Now, shortly after this, three more Shermans crossed the bridge. Again, they were ordered to deploy right of the road. But they kept on the road, and they were sitting targets. The 88, beyond the sunken road, up the Catania Road, knocked out two of the three of them straight away. Now, one was hit just beyond where... Well, one was hit, actually, more or less level where we had walked into the German machine guns during the night. It caught fire, ran backwards off the road, and its tracks tangled in some barbed wire, which caught in the clothing of Jacko, or Jackman, the C Company platoon commander, who had been lying out there all night, lying in the ditch, in actual fact, and it dragged him along the ground for quite a while before the Sherman finally came to rest. He was eventually picked up by German stretcher bearers, taken to Catania Hospital, left there more dead than alive when Catania was evacuated, and eventually found by our own troops. So that was quite an experience for him. But fortunately, just after that, the priests got the range of the 88, soon after the two Shermans were knocked out, brought down a very heavy concentration, which knocked out the gun and literally obliterated the crew. There was people who saw it afterwards, they just weren't there, only bits of them. So that was that, the 88. And how it had stayed there all that time, I don't know, because it was out in the open on the Catania Road.
Seems rather strange the priests hadn't got at it before.
Yes, it was. It was. I mean, looking at its position, you can't see that it's hidden in any way at all. But was slightly off to the left. So
it's rather odd the Shermans didn't manage to
knock it off,
deal
yeah.
with it, because they had a 75mm gun, didn't they?
They did. They should have had. Yes, that was on them by then.
You know, if they'd been able to shoot accurately, they might have hit the thing at that range.
Yes, I don't think. Well, I don't know about them. I don't think they. I agree with you. I think there's something they could have done. They could have done something earlier on too. You know, I don't think they didn't wheel this gun out into the open to fire it. I mean, it was there. It's stationary, but it was about 400 yards beyond the sunken road. So that would be 800 yards from the bridge, but about a half a mile, something like that.
75mm gun should be able to carry that.
Easy. No, I'm just thinking
far.
Of it being spotted. They should have been able to spot it all right.
Something that size, yeah, certainly. The size of the shield was fairly big, wasn't it, on an 88?
That's right.
Well, presumably it was dug in.
I suppose it would have been, yes. It must have been, because it had been there some time, I think. It was there right from the very beginning, I think. Yes. Anyway, the morning wore on, and a lot of harassing fire was coming from the Germans, automatic fire. A company on the right of the road had casualties from snipers in the sunken road, who were, in fact, able to fire across the road at the rear of A Company, who were lining this white wall facing outwards away from the road. It was very, very hot indeed, and they were having a very unpleasant time indeed. Now, there were numerous counterattacks attempted by the Germans all day. Each one of them was broken up by machine gun, mortar, and small arms fire. The battalion mortars fired over 600 bombs during the battle, and together with the Cheshires, they kept up a constant barrage. They broke up every group of paras that formed up, making ready for some sort of counterattack, was immediately broken up. Hampson acted as an OP for his mortars, and he spent a lot of time up forward with the infantry, often in exposed positions, certainly where the fire was heaviest, and quite apart from the fact that he wandered around all the time, flicking a flywhist, which did inspire confidence in quite a lot of people, he spotted targets quite easily from the infantry positions, and at least three enemy counterattacks were broken up. In a very large part, really, his mortars were responsible for that bridgehead holding on as it did. He did a marvellous job, actually, and he got the MC for that.
When the Germans made these counterattacks, what sort of strength were they in?
I don't think they would be. It doesn't. There's nothing very clear about that. I think probably you might have had. They were definitely counterattacks, without any doubt. And I would have thought some of them might have been, depending on where the companies were located, that they were actually counterattacking. It would have been a small group or a largest group. But I think they've just been classified as counterattacks, actually. I don't think there was any one big set piece attack put in against the part of the embankment that B Company was holding.
So these were just local
affairs. Yes, and I think, you see, most of them were broken up before they even got off the ground, before they even were able to start moving. The mortars and the machine guns broke them up, because Hampson was spotting where it was all happening, because he was right up forward with the infantry. What he wasn't spotting was being spotted by the infantry up there. So I don't think you've got a situation there where there was a counterattack developed with 20 or 30 Germans walking across the open ground and advancing. I don't think they got as far as that. I think they were knocked off before they even made a start. In fact, it was a I think when Hampson was running the battalion, Mortar Platoon, it was at about its best, actually. It was very good indeed. They had a chap named Corporal Scriven, and here again he was in the thick of it throughout, and he was responsible for knocking off a lot of the paratroop snipers. He spotted them from various exposed positions, and he was continually shot at, but he was able to direct his mortars to where the snipers were operating from, and he did a great deal of damage, and certainly saved a lot of people on our side.